I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Irvin Welsh's Train Spotting has been a notable literary achievement since its release in 1993. It was his first book in a career that's included 11 novels and 4 short story collections. The latest book is Dead Men's Trousers. It brings back the characters so many have taken to after the Train Spotting film adaptation of 1996 and a number of sequels. We see Renton, Sick Boy, Spud, and Begbie once more. They're in middle age now, confronting a number of realities. Mr. Welsh joins me now. We talk about these characters, the reception his work gets then as now. We also discuss his career, living in the United States, visiting Canada, living elsewhere, and writing. This new book is published by Jonathan Cape. I spoke to Irvin Welsh in Toronto last week while there for an appearance with the Toronto International Film Festival.
Hi.
Hi, Irvin. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Are you enjoying Toronto?
Yeah, I am. What about are you?
I am in Vancouver.
All right. Yeah, great time.
Yeah. I guess the thing that I've always wondered, because I've never been to Europe, and I've never obviously been to Scotland or Ireland or England, is as well, considering that you live in the United States now, does Canada feel sort of like what it feels like, say, back home?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Canada's Canada. It's a different entity altogether from either America or Europe. But I suppose it does, to me, feel more European than the United States does, I think.
Do you like living in the States?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've been there 10 years, so I mean, I can't be disingenuous to say that I don't like it after that length of time. But I do like it. I mean, there's a lot of great things about it. There's a lot of things that are kind of, you know, very, in some ways, it's a very easier place to live than the UK. But, you know, I like living in the UK. You know, I like living in Ireland. I like living in Holland. I've kind of, you know, I think you have to enjoy where you're living, basically. Otherwise, there's no point in being there.
Yeah. How often do you get back to, say, well, I know you're from Scotland, but you lived in Ireland for a spell as well, right?
Yeah.
How often do you get back home, say?
I'm back a lot, actually. I'm usually about 3 months in the year, I'm usually over there.
What do you make of, I mean, looking at your books, what do you make of how people around the world have sort of, I guess, viewed Scotland and how Scots are through your books?
I don't know if they do, but that's quite interesting. It's quite flattering to think that they do. I think, you know, it's like any country, it's a house of many rooms, and there's a lot of divergence of views and opinion and all that in Scotland. I don't think, a lot of divergence of culture as well, you know. I don't think that any one kind of writer or novel or any one kind of thing can be nailed in that way. I think it always is a bit elusive to, you know, any kind of country or culture is a bit elusive, that's the attraction of it, you know. But I don't know, I mean, I really don't know what people think of Scotland, because I don't really know what Scotland thinks of itself right now. It's very much, you know, like the rest of the world, it's very much a place in flux.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think Scots themselves felt, I don't know how to put this, but do you think that when Train Spotting first hit, the book and then the film, that they saw themselves in what you wrote, in those characters, say?
Well, a lot obviously did, you know, because it was, you know, it's been embraced, and the writing's been embraced kind of quite strongly in Scotland by a lot of people. It's also been kind of rejected by a lot of people as well. A lot of people don't like it, you know, and it is, you know, I mean, I'm a very polarizing writer. I'm a very kind of, you know, I'm a very, so, you know, I tend to be somebody that that explores the conflict in society rather than somebody that just kind of glosses over them. You know, and that's just the way I am as a writer, basically. And it's, you know, I'm not saying it's an ideal way to be, but it's just the way I am. You know, I can't really be anything else.
The reviews for Dead Man's Trousers are, I guess polarizing is a word, isn't it? I mean, but at the same time, now that I'm thinking of Train Spotting, when that first came out, you know, I can remember people on television, you know, wagging their fingers saying, don't read this stuff, you know?
It's always been the same. It's never, you know, it's just an interesting thing from Trainspotting to Dead Man's Trousers. It's always been the same. It's always been incredibly kind of, you know, either very for or very against. There's not really much middle ground, you know?
Yeah. But the world has changed, though, hasn't it, in the 20, 25 years or so?
Yeah, massively, massively. It's been, you know, one of the most dynamic, you know, not so much, kind of, until 2008 was the kind of, the crash was a big game changer. Things were pretty dull and static since, you know, after like, from the 2000s, you know, were terrible, were terribly boring and dull. And then it, suddenly, the last 10 years have been absolutely dynamic and, you know, probably the most dynamic decade in human history, basically, like, you know, I mean, the exponential change has been pretty incredible and it's, you know, it's poised to kind of gather momentum rather than lose momentum.
And that's where the characters are in Dead Man's Trousers, isn't it? I mean, they're in their 50s now, and they're leading very different lives than they did when we first met them. They are older. Are they wiser at all?
I don't think they're wiser in the sense that I don't think a lot of us are wiser to the extent that you know, we're busking it. You know, we're in an era where all our certainties have been turned on their head. And we don't really know what's around the corner or what's going on, and we don't really know. We know for sure that there are bad things looming. We don't know how to sort them out. We don't really know how we actually kind of circumvent a lot of the problems that we're going to have ahead.
But through it all, there's still this connection between these four guys, right? I mean, and is that something that you've experienced in being the age that you are now? You're a little older than where the characters are, but I mean, did you have those same friendships from before to today?
Yeah, I still do. I mean, it's like you know, my oldest friends are my closest friends are probably my oldest friends, really. You know, the people that I've known since I was like this New Year, I spent New Year in Sligo with one of my oldest pals who I've known since I was 6 years old, basically. And that's a long, long time.
Yeah.
I mean, like, kind of, you know, like 15 years is a long time. I've known him for, you know, since we were kids, basically. And, you know, a lot of people have known since I was kind of teen, kind of early 20s and all that. So, you know, most of them are still friends now.
Yeah, I guess it's harder for one to make friends, I think, after 30. I mean, and I assume for these guys after 50, that's certainly the case.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't said that. You know, I'm thinking about it. I've made a lot of friends since. You know, you do make friends. You know, it becomes, you rely more on your kind of, you know, people you've got a bit of a history with. But, you know, I tend to make friends relatively easily.
Yeah. Now, you've said in other interviews that you've done that this is the last book that we'll see these characters, I guess three of the four characters. In any way, do you ever see them again, revisiting them, say, when they're senior citizens?
You know, it's a funny thing. It's out of my hands, really. You know, I mean, I keep saying this every time I write them, but, you know, and you kind of keep coming back, you know, so it's something that, you know, it's like I never really know what I'm going to write. I never know what's going to grab me from one sort of year to the next. So I just don't know, you know, it's as simple as that. You know, I might not write a single book about them again, or I might write another three or four, you know, you never know.
Yeah, but in this book, I guess they have to confront the reality of getting older and death. Some people might be surprised that they lasted this long.
Yeah, well, that's why one of them had to die, basically. I mean, I thought it's just impossible that they'd all be around. You know, one of them had to die, and kind of, you know, probably a couple of them had to be sort of rehab cases to an extent. So, make them survive, plausibly, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's interesting, you know, to see where they're at as characters now, but yeah, I mean, you take about, you know, it's fiction, so you get to take license. That's the thing that's the good thing about fiction is you just do get to make things up. That's what it's all about, you know.
Yeah.
And you can make up anything you want. If you try to if you try and kind of, if you compromise that freedom, you have to have some notion of reality and plausibility to make people go with you on that journey. But you can't give up the whole kind of premise of what fiction's about. It's not like social documentary. You do have to kind of make things up. You do have to take a certain kind of dramatic license with what goes on.
I guess the gift of these characters, and I suppose it's all from you, is the fact that a lot of us don't like them. Because, I mean, they're not altogether pleasant or they've got personality traits that we might not, say, subscribe to ourselves. But at the same time, we feel great empathy for them. And for you, as the person who's created them, you must have empathy for them. But beyond that, I mean, you had to like them, don't you?
I think whether you like them or dislike them is irrelevant. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head with the word empathy. You've got to be able to put yourself in their shoes, and you've got to be able to think, well, you know, what would happen logically if all these things had happened to me? If I was in these circumstances, how would I behave, or how would I feel? And you'd like to think, you know, that maybe you'd do things a bit differently, maybe be a bit more compassionate, a bit kinder, but... And a lot of, you know, and a lot of the circumstances they're put into extreme dramatic circumstances, and they have to function, and in that level, they have to function with what they've got, they have to function with the support they've got, and the resources that they have. And sometimes it's easy, from a perspective of distance and a perspective of kind of relative privilege, to say you'd behave differently. Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. You know, so I kind of think that. I like characters to behave badly because, again, it's drama, you know. It's like if people are behaving well right through a novel or a movie, there's no drama, there's no conflict, there's no point in watching it.
Now, after the first Trainspotting film came out, did that influence, in the way that the characters were on screen, did that influence how you wrote them later on?
Probably not. I mean, I think the thing that I had to do was, unfortunately, I had to reread the books again to get the physical descriptions out, you know, of the characters out of my head, you know, and you have to get back into your sense of it. Because every time you see it on stage, or every time you see it, you know, every time somebody makes a movie of any of your books, it's a slightly different universe, which you want it to be. You don't want it to be the same thing, you know. It's got to change to make it interesting to you. But you do. It means you do have to keep some kind of consistency. You do have to go back to the original material. But obviously, it's an influence. I mean, I think I was working with John Hodge and Danny Boyle and Andrew McDonald on Trainspotting 2. I think, you know, that's probably the reason why I ended up writing probably The Blade Artist and Dead Men's Trousers, because I was working with these guys again, and also working with... the two Ewans and Johnny and Bobby, you know, we're talking about the characters and spent a lot of time talking about them, and it does, you know, you draw a lot from the people around you. So not so much the films that influence you, but I think the discussions with other people, and also discussions you have with readers. You know, you go to do these talks and these readings and signings, and people will start giving you their insights about the characters. And you don't really, because writing's such a subconscious process,
yeah.
Sometimes people will nail something you haven't seen yourself. You know, everybody's view of it is different, and you do pick up, you know, it becomes, when you write a book, it becomes, it's a process of giving up. You know, you hand it over to the world, and the world starts handing bits back to you, starts saying, well, this is not really what that character is, and more like this, and more like that. So your perception of it changes the way you're the way the world feeds it back to you. You try and be true to your own sense of it, but your own sense of it is influenced to an extent by the way the world embraces it.
And then, what's it like for you to hear, say, readers or viewers alike talk about these characters in such, because they seem real to them, as a person who's created them, and they've infused their own, say, view onto to them that you may not believe in as well, but I mean, they make these characters larger than life. They make them real for you, don't they?
Yeah, I think they're much more real. I think just in general terms, I think a memorable character from a book is much more real to a reader than it is to an author, because if you're an author, you're constructing it, and you only see the constant drafts to get the character right, to get the voice right, to get the behaviour right. and you see all these constant modifications and adjustments. You see the kind of the technical exercise of it, if you like. You see the process, whereas the reader only sees the output. So, you know, I mean, I'm a big fan of Ulysses, for example. So, Stephen and Bloom are probably kind of, they're very real characters to me, but in much more in a way that than kind of Renton and Begbie and Spud and Sick Boy would be. You know, they're more like they're more constructed sort of kind of, you know, they're more constructs basically, and I can see the construction of them, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas I can't see the construction of Leo Bloom, you know, or Stephen Delezis, you know, in Joyce's mind. I can only see it on the finished product on paper.
Now, you're in Toronto when I'm talking to you. I guess they're screening your film there at the in Toronto, is that right?
Yeah, they're screening both. And I'm going to have a little chat about it, and I'm going to sort of just chat about stuff in general and chat about Dead Men's Trousers and all the stuff I've been up to over the years.
Well, what is it like for you when you meet audiences, as you will shortly? Do you feel that you're treated more as a star than, say, as a writer?
Well, I think, you know, what the thing is, it's a dichotomy that everybody kind of has, is that, you know, the more books that you write, the more successful and well-known you become, the more you become an author rather than a writer. And, you know, they're two very different jobs. You know, the author's a very much a promotional job, and it's very much talking about what you've already done, you know, whereas the writer's about actually doing new stuff and about writing new stuff. Most people kind of, they get into the game because they want to be writers, but they end up kind of becoming authors. It becomes as big a part of the job as being a writer. And the writer's just fun, you know, I think when I'm a writer, I'm relaxed. I feel like I'm enjoying myself. I've retired, basically. Mm-hmm. But as an author, it's more like having a proper job, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like kind of, but, I mean, it's a good job. It's one of the better jobs you can have, but it still feels a bit like a job, whereas a writer feels more like just a hobby.
As a writer and an author, do you, I guess, what parts of it don't you enjoy?
As a writer, I don't enjoy the, there's a kind of, what don't I enjoy as a writer? I mean, I think that sometimes as a writer, you know, you can have very frustrating days. You know, you can have a day where you just can't seem to get past a certain kind of problem or a certain kind of issue. And these can be very kind of, they can be a bit of a bummer, they can be a bit kind of, you know, you think to yourself, why am I doing this? What's the point? This isn't very good. But, you know, as an author, I think it's just, the frustrating thing to me as an author is, like, you know, when you go away on tour and you go to all these interesting places and you only get to see little bits of them, you know, you're on transit and in hotel rooms a lot of the time. And I've tried to give myself an extra day or so, an extra couple of days on tour so I can look around and hang out and just try and be a little bit creative with it, you know. But it's important for me to try to do that. And it makes it much more kind of, you see the whole place basically rather than just, you know, it could be, you know, like a theater where you give a talk, or a hotel room that you stay in, or a transit could, you know, at a restaurant, or it could be anywhere really. But when you get to slip the leash, as I call it, and get off, it's much more interesting.
Were your parents great storytellers?
Everybody in my community was. The whole family were all storytellers, and everybody in the local community, everybody where I grew up in Leith and in Muirhouse and the schemes, they could just chat and talk and tell tales for ages. I mean, the weather's so bad in Scotland that people spend a lot of time indoors in pubs and in houses, and they just chat, they just entertain each other with stories, basically. And I never really thought about that side of it until I moved to Miami into kind of warmer climate, which is a very outdoors culture. Everybody's outside all the time, and it's very visual culture. People don't, it's not an oral culture in the same way that Scotland is. So people are just talking, and because it's quite a harsh industrial culture, you know, people, you know, the tales can be very kind of ribald, and people can rip the piss out of each other and have a, you know, have a laugh, and so it tends to be it's quite an interesting sort of culture to be part of. It's a great, you know, it's a great to be a writer. To actually start, you've got a head start because the stories are all around you. All you need to do is just start setting them down to paper and learn the craft of being able to do that. Yeah.
How do you write? Do you write on paper? Do you write on a computer?
A bit of both. I tend to bang everything onto the computer and work, you know, try and get a draft from the computer and then print it out and then work in the hard copy in some cafe or something like that, you know. So yeah. I do a bit of both, really, yeah.
And then how much time a day do you spend reading?
Not a great deal, really. I mean, I do a lot of... One of the things, again, is like if you're constantly writing, the reading that you do is much more guided. It's much more about the subject matter that you're researching or you're writing about. And it's like I do take a... You know, I'll take... Once I've finished a piece or a draft, you know, I'll take a week off and just read some books for pleasure. Basically, I'll go and buy some books. I've stopped getting books sent to me for blurbs and all that. I used to do that all the time, but it was just kind of completely killing my pleasure of reading. You know, it's like I used to love going to a bookshop, browsing and buying a book, and I couldn't go near bookshops for a while. I just kind of, and I realized it was because I was getting so many books sent to me.
Yeah.
It was just killing my, you know, and feeling, you know, obliged to read them. So I've just stopped all that now. I just don't do it anymore.
But you do read widely. I saw an article where you had to give your favorite books, I think, online, and it's a very disparate list, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of much more... It's funny, I'm much more into nonfiction now. I think it's because of the way, you know, the way the world is.
Yeah.
The big kind of changes and challenges. I'm much more into reading about economics and philosophy and kind of political science and history and kind of all sorts of things like kind of, you know, like science and spirituality and all that kind of stuff now. So I'm trying to get into everything that's kind of every kind of tool that's helping me understand the changing world.
You mentioned living in Miami, and you described earlier what it was like growing up in Scotland amongst the people that you grew up with in terms of the storytelling and the sort. Has your writing at all changed living in America this past decade or so?
I don't know if it has, really. I mean, I think that, I mean, obviously, it must have in some way, but I can't really see it just now myself. I mean, it's like, I've written a couple of books that have been set in Miami, so it's obviously had an impact on me. And, you know, I'm doing one now that's set in Las Vegas, so, you know, there's obviously been some kind of an impact there, but I think that your sensibilities as a writer are formed by your kind of childhood and your sort of youth. And I think that, you know, that's just as you are as a person, I think you are as a writer. These are your formative years, and they influence you into what kind of writer you're going to be. So I think that I think maybe if I lived in Edinburgh, if I lived in London, kind of solidly all the way through, I'd still probably be writing in a pretty similar vein.
Mm-hmm. Finally, I want to reading up on you and over the years and sort of knowing you as one does when one's a public figure. You've always struck me as someone who doesn't really like to look back, who's not nostalgic. I mean, are you at all?
No, I'm not really. I mean, it's like it's funny. I've got a pal that I go out for a drink with when I get back to Edinburgh, and he can tell me kind of. What jumper I was wearing. We can tell me about one night we were in a pub in 1979.
Yeah.
And what jumper I had on and what shirt and all that. He's got an incredible memory. And to me, it's like kind of, I just can't think in that way. You know, I can think in the present, very much in the present. And I can think, maybe I can plan maybe about 2 weeks ahead or something like that. But I find it very, very difficult to go beyond that. I'm very much in the moment. Yeah.
It's not a bad way to live though, right?
It's a good way to live in a lot of ways. I think it's got its downside as well. I mean, it's like kind of fun. But you do kind of... I think it's important to try and enjoy the moment wherever you are or whatever your material circumstances are. And, you know, sometimes it's like... you know, if you go... You know, we all go through good times and bad times in life. And I think sometimes it's like when we go through bad times, we try to kind of force ourselves, you know, understandably, to rush past the moment. But I think you've got to try and find the interest and the education and the opportunity for learning and growth through these bad times as well, you know. So
yeah.
not be too much in a hurry to kind of get past them.
Mm-hmm. Irvin, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. I appreciate your time today. All the best.
No, thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Irvin Welsh joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.